The Chicago Theater of the Air. Produced and narrated by Marion Clare, conducted by Henry Weber, written by Jack LeBrondre, directed tonight by Glenn Ransom, Mutual presents one of America's foremost radio programs, the famous Chicago Theater of the Air productions of the world's greatest musical dramas. Tonight, a special New Year's performance of The Merry Widow by Franz Lehár, starring Nancy Carr, David O'Leary, and Earl Wilkie, with dramatic cast headed by Everett Clark and John Barclay, and the chorus under the direction of Robert Trendler. Ladies and gentlemen, the first few minutes of tonight's Chicago Theater of the Air production will be devoted to a significant radio commentary by Colonel Robert R. McCormick, noted historian, outspoken American patriot, and distinguished editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. On this eve of 1950, Colonel McCormick will speak on the vital subject, Facts of Wealth. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick.
My object is to correct for the new year a misconception in economics so widespread as be almost universal. That politicians should preach it is not surprising, because they do not know any better. But professors with most of the alphabet after their names, who should know better, are just as thoroughly sunk in ignorance. The misconception is that there is just so much wealth in the world that it cannot be increased, and that it is unchangeable. This was a misconception preached by that evil ignoramus, Karl Marx. It was perceivably untrue in his day, 100 times more so now. Ownership of land in England sprang from the feudal system, where the overlords held land in great quantities to furnish the military power to defend the country. It was not until the reign of Charles II that the feudal system was finally resolved into land ownership called in the law of real property, common socage. Ownership of land at that time very much followed the great feudal holdings. In 1873, Joseph Medill wrote, "The upper crust number perhaps 100,000 families, or half as many persons as the paupers. One third of these, 33,000, are born nobles and own all the land." The value of land was mostly agricultural, and until approximately 100 years ago, was tilled by wooden plows, hoes, and shovels. Whether these were owned by the tenant or the landlord, their value was trifling. Land undershot with coal, of course, had additional value, as land covering iron ore, tin, lead, and copper, and other minerals found in England. Until the invention of the steam engine, all manufacturing, whether carriages or clothes, paper, books, furniture, or carpets, was done by hand in little shops. To this day in England, horseshoes are individually hammered out by blacksmiths. Wealth other than land was found in trading companies, which owned ships and liquid capital. Ships were made individually, as they are to this day, the only instrument so made and therefore remaining preponderantly of British production. It was Eli Whitney, inventor of the cotton gin, who first devised mass production. Jefferson spoke with amazement of this man who could produce interchangeable parts of muskets, each part fitting in its place in any one of them. Steam engines attached to looms introduced the Industrial Revolution. Wealth was created as it had never been created before. The steam engine became the steam locomotive, requiring many cars and rails for its operation. It created a form of transportation which, paying for its capital and paying taxes, was able to take traffic away from high roads and canals, supported at public expense. Marx saw the railroads make the land of the great landowners more valuable, while the tenants and employees labored as their forefathers had done for 1,000 years. He saw wealth come in from manufactured exports and from trading companies, the wealth lodging in a few hands and remaining there because of the law of primogeniture. This was the industrial condition of which Karl Marx became aware and thought it was the sum total of all wealth, and that if it could be taken over by government for the benefit of all people, all the wealth would be shared. He did not see the good that these manufactured articles did to their purchases, nor did he appreciate that pure robbery in the Orient was bringing in more income to England than legitimate business. He did not look across the Atlantic, where first the steamboat navigating the rivers, then the railroads, opened up wastelands to be owned by countless immigrants, and where laws against primogeniture assured its continuous distribution. He did not realize that the age of invention, instead of being finished, was just about to begin. His followers are still living with him 100 years ago. The cable and telegraph made wealth for their investors and inventors, but they made far more wealth for their users. They have been superseded by radio, and the once wealth they had had disappeared. So was it with the wooden ships and shipyards, superseded by iron and then by steel. Telephones, transatlantic or local, lengthened the legs of the users 1,000 times. Steam power at first was produced at the point of use and connected to machines by belting or gears. With electricity, produced by steam or water and raised to the most useful voltage, the point of consumption may be hundreds of miles away from the place of production. And because consumers do not use the power at the same time, a production unit may supply twice as many consumer units. As I said before, mass production began with Eli Whitney. The principle grew rapidly until most all manufacturing is done by mass production. That new inventions and improvements create new wealth and at the same time destroy old wealth is the obvious fact politicians and professors do not see. At the turn of the century, the automobile came in, giving rise to automobile roads, a form of socialism, which, like our other social activity, waterworks, are badly managed as in New York, where serious catastrophe is threatened because of governmental ineptitude. Socialist electrical production is equally inefficient. In Washington State, a naval ship had to be called upon to supply the deficit of electricity from the municipal plant. The Ontario Power Commission is short of power and is buying the surplus steam of some of its customers. The military services, the most public of enterprises, receive most of their invention and improvements from private enterprise. The most extraordinary instrument for loading anti-aircraft guns was produced by a shoe machine manufacturing company. Older people remember housework done with a broom and tea leaves spread on the carpet to absorb the dust. The broom long ago gave way to the carpet sweeper, and now the carpet sweepers have been superseded by vacuum cleaners. Vacuum cleaners, incidentally, did away with the fleet of San Francisco, while the tea leaves now go to Atlanta to make Coca-Cola. The great lumber industry has shrunk, giving way to pulps and plastics. Shingles are now made from asphalt, which is no more a major road material. Some lumbermen have committed themselves to the change, but most of them could not learn new tricks. The father of a friend of mine had a fine business in wooden windmills. When these gave way to steel, he turned his woodworking factory and carpenters to making buggies. Now, windmills and buggies have both been made obsolete by international combustion engines. The automobile originating in France is a rich man's luxury. Through mass production, has become almost as common as shoes in this country, which incidentally were not so common 100 years ago. The automobile grew into the truck, which now serves either from door to door or across the continent. Large newspaper circulations are as much due to the use of trucks as to improved printing machines. Internal combustion engines have brought navigation back to the rivers and also power the airplane, both passenger and freight, so that the railroads, once the creator of our greatest fortunes, are finding it difficult to remain in business, and the value is pretty well washed out of them. Washing machines and other household appliances have taken the drudgery out of housework. Farm machinery, also about 100 years old, has been constantly improving, also through the internal combustion engine. The time is coming, but it is not already here, when the machinery will be more valuable than the land it cultivates. Our historical fundamental wealth will be relegated to minor importance. The internal combustion engine, originated by Otto, did not burn coal as he expected, but oil, which is produced in great quantities and which has many byproducts. Aluminum is taken from the soil by electricity and magnesium from ocean water. Glass, once used exclusively for windows of cathedrals and palaces, now has an infinite number of uses. Something of chemistry has been known for centuries. Its early practitioners, known as alchemists, were fakers like the early astrologists. But fortunately, their much more difficult science was not interfered with by theologians. Mistaken theories, as they were disproved, gave way to correct ones. Applied chemistry was largely of German origin. Its secrets were taken from the Germans after World War I, and America had become the principal producer of chemical articles in the world. We know of them generally as medicines and plastics, as synthetics such as rayon and nylon, and the many steel compounds which most people do not comprehend. In addition to the old metals, gold, silver, tin, zinc, copper, and iron, have come, among others, nickel, aluminum, tungsten, cadmium, magnesium, and many others, including uranium. From the last came the atom bomb, and from it, we have recently been told, has been developed a fuel as cheap as coal. These are all available for manufacturing purposes to people who know or learn how to combine them. So that wealth consists in knowledge more than in materials. As knowledge and the know-how pass with the possessor, the wealth passes with him, nor is this confined to the sciences. A bank which had been outstanding for its soundness under a certain president for a generation failed after that man died. Corporations can have perpetual charters, but that does not give them perpetual good management. The Pullman Company has gone through all the metamorphoses of sleeping cars from wood to stainless steel streamliners, but there's not been a Pullman in it for 50 years. Probably the number of successful institutions that have remained in the same family for 100 years could be counted on the fingers of both hands. From the above it is plain that wealth is born, grows, and dies like men. How long will it be before this obvious fact finds its way to the campuses?
Speaking from the stage of the Chicago Theater of the Air on the eve of 1950s, Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, has delivered a significant address on the vital subject, Facts of Wealth, free copies of which may be obtained by writing to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago 11, Illinois. Ladies and gentlemen, the curtain rises on tonight's Chicago Theater of the Air special New Year's production, The Merry Widow by Franz Lehár, starring Nancy Carr, David Poleri, and Earl Wilkie, with narration by Marion Clare. The Merry Widow.
permit me to introduce myself. I am the widow Sonia, just recently arrived here in Paris from my native land of Marsovia. Since I am a widow, you'd naturally expect my face to be fascinatingly sad and my striking figure adorned in the conventional black of deep mourning. But how can you expect my face to be sad when my heart is gay? And why adorn a figure in black when it simply cries out for organdy and lace in all the brilliant colors of the feminine spectrum? Then, too, you must remember that I was never really in love with my husband. He was terribly old, and everyone knows I married him simply because Prince Danilo waited too long to ask the question I was simply dying to hear. I wonder whatever happened to Prince Danilo. Not that it really matters, because here in Paris, I seem to attract suitors as easily as Lorelei lures sailors from the sea. Compete for my favor. But I forgot to mention that I have wealth as well as beauty. After all, my poor husband had to have something. He certainly wasn't handsome, and his youth was far behind him. Did I mention that I'm at the Marsovian embassy in Paris? Oh, it slipped my mind, I guess. But really, where else would you expect me to be? My husband was well acquainted with Baron Popoff, our Marsovian ambassador in Paris. And after all, Paris is a dangerous city. And naturally, a young widow as attractive as I needs a great deal of protection.
Oh, good evening, Baron Popoff. Why the trembling lip and wrinkled brow?
Good evening, Raph. Prince Danilo, do you realize that Marsovia's ship of state is sinking? Our country's destitute. No funds for the treasury. Everything's up to you.
Up to me? Come now, Baron. This is all very flattering. But Mummy and I have been strangers for years.
Prince Danilo, a wealthy Marsovian widow arrived in Paris this very night.
Oh, no. No widows for me. I'm allergic to black.
Well, our king has sent his order, my boy.
Huh? What order?
You are instructed to court this widow and marry her within 24 hours. Her wealth can save our Marsovian government.
24 hours? Well, orders are orders, I suppose. Good night, Baron. I have just 24 hours to live a lifetime, and Maxime's is the place to live it.
I must warn you, Danilo. No complications with the girls at Maxime's. Remember, you potentially represent the entire Mastovian treasury.
I go off to my sea, where foreign promises, with all the girls I scatter, my flattered chips and flatter. Long, long ago to you, long, long ago to you, for surnames do not matter, I take the first to hand.
And when the courts go fast, we dance in their respect.
Then I refresh my tired brain with little suppers and champagne, and look into the lady's eyes. Till they and I are close allied. So in a glass of sparkling wine, a vision of a world divine. Oh, I can wish upon a star, as well as any lock and bar. A world of lace and silken hose, a pretty face upturned of nose. And when each one becomes a bore, I order up a dozen more.
At the time, I had no idea that Marsovia was destitute or that Baron Popoff had made such definite plans for my future. But Lady Popoff, acting as her husband's missionary, wasted no time in briefing me on the situation.
Don't misunderstand, my dear Sonia. We're not asking for a loan. The king merely requests that you marry a member of the Marsovian nobility.
I felt it quite useless to ask if they had any particular husband in mind. Lady Popoff's very manner warned me that, as far as Marsovia was concerned, everything had been arranged.
I realize, my dear, that you've but recently arrived in Paris, and quite understandably you regret having to forsake the city's pleasures so soon.
Lady Popoff couldn't possibly realize how mildly she was describing my predicament. I had heard so much about Paris, and particularly about a place called Maxime.
But, of course, having never tasted the pleasures of Paris, you'll never miss them, my dear.
I haven't been in Paris long, and when I meet a man, I'm always saying something wrong. I'm no Marsovian, for when a man would wed a girl in my own native land, he doesn't
Oh, friendly fellow do. Come and look for us in Athens. We are here to comfort you.
Maxine, just a moment.
Huh? Oh, Prince Danilo. Now I know why my girls look so eager tonight. It is because you are here, of course.
I'm afraid it will do them no good to look eager, Maxine. I am doomed.
Huh? Doomed?
My last 24 hours of freedom. I want you to introduce me to the most beautiful mademoiselle in all Paris. This must be my farewell to romance.
The most beautiful mademoiselle in all Paris? Oh, la la. This is like trying to find an orchid among orchids.
Oh, you're right, Maxime. How can a man be expected to select one among so many? Sometimes I think that King Solomon had the right idea.
Oh, the women, how to win their jealous brain. That's an eye-night thrill of dinner, for there is no one to swing. Winning women, for another love is done, that's what nobody discovers, not even any son. With one you have to flirt and flatter, so and so and so and so, and put another on the apple, so and so and so and so. Another likes you when you bluster, so and so and so and so, and while you beat her you can thrust her, so and so and so and so. One asks for tenderness and flagging, so and so and so and so, another's always bragging, nagging, so and so and so and so. Another likes incessant laughter, so and so and so and so. And other things they ask for after, so and so and so and so. You may study the ways as you can.
Oh, the women's glass, the
women's too much for a
man. Oh, the women's pain, the
deeper than diving for pearls. Causing girls,
girls, girls, girls, girls.
With a fair flaxen hair, eyes of blue.
Oh, the wind's dying.
A long way to knowing for you. She is dark or she's fair. She may smile or a frown. Never mind, you will get done brown.
Women.
You may study her ways as you can. A woman too much for a man.
Women,
women, and I be for
pearls.
Parting girls, 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 girls. With her fair flaxen hair, eyes of blue. She's a long way to knowing for you. She is dark or she's fair. She may smile or may frown. Never mind, you will get done wrong.
I'm sure that you too will easily understand why I came to Maxime's unescorted. My time was so short and there was so much to see. Maxime himself came forward to greet me and I asked him for a table.
But of course, mademoiselle, sit right here. What a pity you are unescorted.
I tried to explain.
You see, monsieur, I have just 24 hours of freedom, and I prefer to see Paris alone.
So? Oh, you are married, yes?
I found it quite difficult to explain.
It is this way, monsieur. I am married, and yet I am not married. You see, I haven't as yet met my husband-to-be.
Mademoiselle, I shall someday write a book. I will call it Woman, the Great Unsolved Mystery.
My marriage will be one arranged, quite in the modern style. My name is all that will be changed, that's in the modern style. And as I shan't be on the shelf, not for a little while, I
mademoiselle. Now I understand your plight. And quite by coincidence, there is a gentleman here whom I would like to have you meet.
Maxime pointed toward a gentleman walking rapidly toward my table. My heart almost stopped. Danilo. Prince Danilo. I recognized him immediately, but I realized as he spoke that he did not place me as the little Sonia he once courted in Varsovia.
Maxime, you're right. She's an absolute dream. By far the most beautiful mademoiselle in all Paris.
His enthusiasm was flattering, but quite embarrassing in public. I asked him to speak more softly.
But don't you understand, mademoiselle? Maxime tells me that you have but 24 hours of freedom. I, too, have but one day left.
So this was the Danilo I had once set my heart on. I couldn't help feeling his bold assurance. Monsieur, I have heard that Paris is a city of handsome men. Now I realize that such reports are not exaggerated.
To say nothing of beautiful women. And to think that tomorrow night I am expected to marry an old ogre with an hourglass corset and a lorgnette.
He was inviting trouble. So, I did not disappoint him. Exactly my position, monsieur. I am expected to marry a crotchety old nobleman with watery eyes and a bald head.
Oh, mademoiselle, this is like a fantasy. Here today and gone tomorrow.
I couldn't help but lead him on. His assurance angered me, but the night was young. Perhaps if I carried on, my revenge would be more complete. Monsieur, perhaps you would like an adventure in fantasy.
With you, mademoiselle, any adventure.
Thank you.
fate had only brought us together sooner.
How could I tell him that fate had brought us together a long time ago? Prince Danilo, perhaps fate had a good reason for keeping us apart.
But only 24 hours. A lifetime to live in 24 hours.
I almost felt as he did. What a pity that such a night as this must end. This Danilo. Once I loved him, but when I was penniless, he cast me aside. Now that I have money, oh, it can never be. Prince Danilo, I am a Cinderella who must disappear at midnight.
Now, mademoiselle, I hope our midnight never comes.
My dear.
What is it, Baron? Good heavens, your teeth are chattering like castanets.
Oh, something dreadful's happened. This is terrible.
Please compose yourself and stop trembling.
But this message, there's a legal clause somewhere in Madame Sonia's will.
What?
If the widow Sonia marries, her entire fortune is forfeit.
Forfeit?
If her wealth is to be saved from our Sovia, she must remain unwed.
Horrors, what are we to do?
And keep her from matrimony is our only hope. But it will be like moving the moon, my dear. No man can resist her. Whatever it is that women are supposed to have. She has twice as much of it.
Baron Popoff, and at your age, too.
Popoff had known how I detested this Prince Danilo, he would have set his mind at rest. Why, I wouldn't marry this boastful philanderer if he were the last man on... Oh, it's a waste of breath to talk about it. Our evening at Maxime's is about over, and soon I will have my revenge. I will laugh in his face.
Oh, how quickly the night has come to an end, mademoiselle. If only my heart weren't pledged to another,
I hardly dare speak the things in my heart, mademoiselle.
Trivial nonsense. What an awakening he will soon get, this Prince Danilo.
There once were two princes' children who loved while the world was so young, but never were happy together. It's just as the poet has sung. The prince never told of his passion for very good reasons.
Lovely mademoiselle. If only I weren't pledged to that baggy-eyed old shrew tomorrow night,
This was the chance I was waiting for. My words had the effect I wanted.
Quite so, monsieur. And if only I weren't pledged to that gouty old nobleman at the Marsovian Embassy.
What? Marsovian Embassy? Did you say Marsovian Embassy?
The confusion was simply a joy to behold.
But wait! Are you the wealthy Marsovian widow I'm pledged to marry?
Oh, I enjoy this discomfort.
Quite true, Prince Danilo. I am your devoted Sonia, your baggy-eyed old shrew.
Sonia, you! After all these years, I never would have known you. Who could have guessed that such beauty could... Wait, you called me a gouty old noble.
Here was my chance, and I took every advantage of it.
Prince Danilo... I wouldn't marry you if Marsovia were swallowed by Russia. You're nothing but a philandering jackass of a nobleman.
What? You dare to call the jackass of Marsovia a prince? I mean the prince of Marsovia jackass.
Oh, joy, oh, joy.
Yeah, what are you doing here, Baron?
You hear, Natalie, a lover's quarrel.
Isn't it wonderful, Baron? It's more than we could possibly hope for.
Wait, what are you two so overjoyed about? I thought...
Oh, things have changed, my dear Danilo. I wouldn't think of asking you to marry this widow.
Well, I don't quite understand this. The fact seems to be that, if you people will excuse me.
This was something I hadn't counted on. Somehow, he didn't seem as concerned as I hoped he might be.
Oh, just a minute, Danilo. Where do you intend to go?
Why? Does it concern you?
Of course it doesn't, my dear Sonia. Come, Lady Natalie and I will escort you from now on.
I'm going to Maxine's. I've done with lover's dreams. The girls will laugh and greet me. They will not trick and cheat me. Low, 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 juju. Low, 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 go, go, go. I'm going off to Maxine's. And so, my dear, goodbye.
Just a minute, Prince Danilo.
Oh, good night, Maxine.
You are not well, Prince. Never have I known you to leave the girls at Maxime's before closing time.
Somehow everything seems different, Maxime. I don't think you'd understand. Good night. If only I hadn't been so stupid. Why didn't I tell her that no one else in the world mattered? Why didn't I...
Why didn't you, Prince?
Oh. Sonia.
I had a terrible time getting away from the pop-off.
Why have you come here?
Perhaps I wanted to apologize for calling you a gouty old nobleman with a bald head and watery eyes.
And I apologize for calling you a baggy-eyed old widow with an hourglass corset and lorgnette.
What else did you want to call me and tell me, Prince?
Not here.
Where are you taking me?
Kiss and will not tell. Oh, tender secret it may share, when we bid a lover's last farewell. Though it is dark around, there will love's light be found. Nothing there to see, my dear.
Sonia, believe me, your fortune means nothing to me. I only agreed to marry a wealthy widow as a patriotic duty to my country. Your real fortune is in your eyes, your lips, and...
I should have answered him, but somehow I couldn't. All I could do was listen.
Love in my heart awaking, a rose bud in the May, into full beauty breaking, became a rose today. I hardly mark it falling, but through the sun thrilled me when it opened and filled my heart with love. And now I know my passion, my love must now be told. The rose that love can fashion shall bloom inside a pool. My heart
depended on his answer. Danilo, suppose I had no fortune to offer Marsovia.
When you look at me like that, beloved, I can forget Marsovia. No wealth in the world can compare with the fortune that is you.
Yeah.
Doris, the worst has happened, Natalie.
Oh, Baron, this is terrible, terrible.
Baron, what do you mean by interrupting the greatest moment of my life?
Sonia, you can't do it. You simply cannot marry this woman chaser. Why, he has a girl in every part.
A moment, Popoff. You have no right to dig up my past.
That's why. Can't I marry him, Baron?
If you marry, your estate is forfeit. Marsov is lost.
What?
Danilo, my boy, I know a perfectly ravishing creature who owns an oil well in Bar Scotia. You'd have a fortune of your own.
No, no, I have found my fortune, Baron. Marsovia will have to look elsewhere.
But, my dear prince...
There was his answer. I was his fortune. What I thought was hate was love, after all. Baron Popoff, whoever told you that my fortune is forfeit when I marry, forgot one very important detail.
Eh, what detail?
By the terms of my husband's will, my next husband receives my entire estate.
Sonia, is this true?
Dandino, my boy, she's lovely. I wouldn't give her up for the world. The feminine law is a wonderful thing, my boy, and Sonia has everything. Wealth and other things.
Baron Popoff, kindly confine your studies of feminine law to me.
But this is in the interest of our Sonia Fury for the league to go my ear, my dear.
You may study her ways as you come. But a woman's too much for a man. Keep her the time you confirm. Courting girls, 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 girls. With a fair fact of hair eyes of blue. She's a long way to glory for you. She is dark, but she's fair. She may smile.
Produced and narrated by Marion Clare, conducted by Henry Weber, written by Jack McAndre, and directed tonight by Glenn Ransom, this has been an original Chicago Theater of the Air production of The Merry Widow by Franz Lehar, starring Nancy Carr in the title role, David Polari as Danilo, Earl Wilkie as Popoff. Featured speaker was Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Robert Trendler was in charge of the chorus. Performance rights were granted by the Thames Whitmark Music Library. Heard in synchronized speaking roles tonight, Marion Clare as Sonia, Everett Clark as Danilo, Muriel Bremner as Natalie, John Barclay as Baron Popoff, Norman Gottschalk as Maxine. This is Lee Bennett cordially inviting you to next week's Chicago Theater of the Air production, Franz Lehar's Frederica, starring Nancy Carr and David Polari. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.